Welcome to the Wild Heart Meditation Center podcast. We're excited to announce that we will now be releasing these episodes every week on Wednesday morning. The best way to support us is by clicking subscribe and taking a moment to rate the podcast wherever you listen. If you'd like to support our efforts to keep the nonprofit Meditation Center open in Nashville, you can donate via the Venmo app by sending your donation to @WildHeartNashville. Or you can go to wildheartmeditationcenter.org and click the donate tab. Thanks for listening.
Thank you everyone for your practice. I find it more motivating to have these nights to do them together. So thanks for showing up for us and for yourselves. I love, Sid, that you brought up the Dhammapada. One of my favorite verses will open tonight. The doors to the deathless are open. Let those who can hear act upon and demonstrate their faith. The doors to the deathless are open. Let those who can hear act upon and demonstrate their faith. This path is really complex because it's so simple, I think. And, you know, right before the Buddha's awakening, and he was working with doubt. It's one of his hindrances, the last hindrance before his awakening. You know, Mara said, "You're not going to be able to teach this. No one's going to understand it." And then the Buddha thought, "But there are those with few dust in their eyes. And maybe they'll understand." So that's what I think of whenever it says, let those who can hear act upon and demonstrate their faith. And that's us in this space tonight. We put in the time and the effort to demonstrate our faith. And with every Dharma talk, every sit, every act of intent to understand how to non-harm, we're gradually digging out the dirt in our ears to see if we can hear better, right? And when we say the doors to the deathless are open, deathless can seem kind of maybe that's leaves room for being misunderstood. But for me, the way that I interpret that is I think of the cycle of samsara, birth, aging, sickness, death, right? And but that's all related to suffering, dukkha. And so to me, when it says the doors to the deathless are open, earlier, I think, Rana, you said something like groundlessness. And I feel like this practice is, how do we find ground in the groundlessness? How do we get out of this wheel of samsara, this rat race, this hamster wheel, and find something that is more everlasting? The one attachment that is safe to cling to, right? To me is this path. And so we do talk about dukkha a lot. Dukkha meaning, you know, anything that's uneasy or uncomfortable, pain, suffering, however you want to call it. And the Four Noble Truths are centered around suffering, right? I think that's why a lot of people in recovery float toward this path. There's suffering, the origin of suffering. There is cessation to suffering. And then finally, how do we end suffering? And then, you know, we have the Noble Eightfold Path. Sukha, I think it's funny, first of all, that they're very similar in words. Sukha, meaning happiness, pleasure, ease, joy, or bliss. And sukha is set up as a contrast to, I hope I'm saying this right, Preya. P-R-E-Y-A, meaning a transient pleasure, whereas the pleasure of sukha has an authentic state happiness within a being that is lasting. So, how do we attain sukha, this otherworldly sustaining happiness, while we're navigating the relative world where there is a lot of suffering and a lot of things that we can't control? I've been thinking a lot about this, and I was listening to a Dharma talk the other day, and I sat after, and in it, she had referenced, I can't remember who the speaker was, but she had referenced untangling the heart. And I loved that because it gave me a really great visual about how to work with whatever stories, imprints were on my heart, mind, these things that that get us in the hamster wheel, right? These subtle things that we don't even notice, but totally change the course of our lives. And so in my sit, I saw my heart and I saw all these vines wrapped around it. And I was trying to figure out how to unwrap my heart. And I knew that if I was to just yank them off, that it would hurt, right? And so I thought to myself, okay, well, I'll just start to take off one vine at a time. So I started slowly, gently doing that. And then I picked up my heart, and then there is a pool of slime underneath it. And then I looked around and I saw a pool of water. So I took this slimy heart and I just dumped it in. I was like, oh, I can just dunk it in and put it back. And I bring this up because I think before I really had a discipline coming back to this practice, in that kind of visual, I probably would have just picked up my heart, saw the slime and been like, oh, gross, or why is there slime, or what am I supposed to do? And all of a sudden it's like, you know, what am I doing now? I'm like, if my heart is still slimy, I'm not really doing anything useful. You know, but by having that extra pause, I think, you know, I had some insight in that visual because I was able to kind of look around and I was like, oh, there's a pool of water. Just dunk it in there, clean it off and put it back, you know? And so this concept of untangling the heart to me is a question of how can I make agitation, the agitation of everyday life, less personal? How can I get more comfortable abiding in the groundlessness or this kind of this sense of a void, right? A lot of the reason I think, I'll speak for myself, that I find tension, clinging, is because who I am and what I believe and these very fixed views, if I'm clinging to it too much, it doesn't make me very adaptable or changeable. And so to me, I feel like there needs to be, and that's what it's laid out in the practice, there needs to be an element of renouncing some of these mental formations about I, me, my, this is it, you know, and it requires a lot of generosity in our parts to try and to try to do that over and over again, even if, you know, other people are very staunch in their ways and it harms us. That's hard, you know? And it's not that this path is necessarily passive, it's a very active path. But it is also one of great skill choosing, you know, when it is time for standing firmly in our ways, or when it's time to be a little bit more fluid, you know, and to remember that how we touch those times of discomfort is really the reflection of how we do everything in life. It's how we interact with the world. in this Dharma talk, she also said, what would it be like to go into a room and walk up to someone and say, will you make me happy? And I was like, oh my God, when you put it like that, that sounds terrible. And that's what a lot of people do. We go into jobs and we say, will you make me happy? We enter a partnership, will you make me happy? We eat a piece of whatever it is, choose your favorite snack, will you make me happy? We have a child, will you make me happy? It's sunny outside, will you make me happy? It's ridiculous. It sounds really ridiculous. This also, you know, on this train of thought around I, me, my, I think it also really calls for, you know, in this path, I think there might be confusion around like how the Buddha views self. And my teacher has explained it to me, such as it's less about no self and more about understanding that the self is a constellation, is how I've heard it described. It's a constellation, right? We talk about causes and conditions. And so the self is a constellation of all of these stories, these interactions, these causes and conditions. I really like that. Because it takes this like single pointedness of self and it spreads it out. And to me, it becomes a little bit more approachable in terms of, is this part of me useful? Is this part of me useful? Is this part true? You know, it becomes more of an activity where we can actually inquire into different parts of ourselves. This question of sukha, otherworldly happiness, also makes me think of, so I'm a social worker by academia. That's what I studied. And there's this concept of inner versus external locus of control. And it's that as the environment around you changes, that you can either attribute success or failure to things that you have control over, or to forces outside of your influence. And it's been shown that the way that you orient yourself around this has a lot of effect on your resilience to life's ups and downs. This concept of a locus of control is coined back to the 60s with Julian Rotter. And it's a really great investigation into how people's behaviors, not only their behaviors, but also their attitudes. So in our mindfulness practice, the quality of our awareness, how do we meet the thought as it arises? Are we like, stop thinking? Or are we like, oh, a thought, you know? So it's not just the behaviors that we do, but it's also the attitudes and the attitudes toward those behaviors that affect our lives, the quality of our lives. And so, you know, as you can imagine, people who develop an internal locus of control or believe that they have responsibility for their own success can, you know, naturally have a tendency to think that there's more options, right? Oh, there's slime on my heart. I wonder what I can do. And you find a pool of water, dunk it, and then come back. Versus the external locus of control, which believes that it's kind of this fatalist view, external forces, things like luck, you know, or whatever it is, that's it. That's just how things are. There's slime on my heart. Well, that's just the way it is, you know? And so when we think about sukha, you know, for me, I would find it a lot easier to attain sukha or something closer to it by walking this path that has fully acknowledges and encourages us to cultivate an inner locus of control. And this is really, you know, Cultivating an environment that's conducive to sukha, otherworldly pleasure, bliss, rapture, that's not contingent upon conditions. It is really laid out in the Noble Eightfold Path. And so, for those, it's for those who may not be familiar, it's really easy to, excuse me, it's beneficial for me to categorize the Eightfold Path in three buckets: wisdom, morality or ethics, and then, discipline or meditation, however you want to call it. So, cultivating the environment for sukha, the first bucket, wisdom, right view, and right thought. So, I'll just quickly read these handy little handouts from my teacher. I'll try to skim through this. Right view, also known as right understanding, encompassing observations that lead us away from delusion or wrong views, the wisdom that truly comprehends cause and effect. Developing right view takes time and determination, the gradual accumulation of understanding and insight as the fruit. Let's see here. Yeah, right intention, also known as right thought. Our view or how we understand and see the world shapes our thoughts and intentions. In turn, thoughts and intentions shape our actions. With intentions based on right view, we can steer our actions in a wholesome direction. When we practice with right intention or right thought, we attempt to protect ourselves from thoughts that lead to suffering. So the three intentions are intention toward renunciation, intention toward goodwill, and intention toward harmlessness. The next bucket is morality or ethics. Right speech. Words radiate power. Packed within them are the potential to benefit, to build up, or for harm. They can heal a wound. The Buddha encourages us away from harmful uses of words. So, a common check for whether something is worth being said, like Sid was mentioning earlier, is it truth? Truthful, useful, timely, kind. Perfect speech. Right action. Buddha points out that suffering is caused by craving. Within the untrained mind, craving leads directly to actions that fulfill it. Kind of like a dog with a bone, right? We cut through the delusion that fulfillment of desire will bring happiness on this path. Through right action, we renounce the harmful actions that are laid out in the five precepts. Like Kai was talking about, abstain from taking life, from taking what is not given, from sexual misconduct, false speech or lying, and then from substances that lead to heedlessness. Right, livelihood is the last of the second bucket of morality or ethics. So livelihood, of course, is the way that we obtain what we need to survive. And this is again how we spend a lot of our times, especially as Americans, right? Livelihood is based on ethical principles or practice. Certain occupations are not considered to be conducive to spiritual practice because they breach the principles that we just laid out and can cause harms to ourselves or others. So ultimately, what a lot of this is about is creating the conditions so that we don't have remorse when we sit down, because it's really difficult to work toward otherworldly happiness if we're constantly thinking about how why we did that and how shitty it feels. And the last bucket is you can call it meditation or mindfulness discipline, but right effort. To accomplish anything worthwhile, we must put effort into the task. With effort, we can abandon thoughts, views, and intentions that are unskillful and create suffering. The Buddhist prescription for overcoming suffering includes four great efforts. One, to prevent the arising of unarisen, unwholesome states. To abandon unwholesome states that have already arisen. To arouse wholesome states that have not yet arisen. To maintain and perfect wholesome states that have already arisen. That's such a rich one. I feel like that could be a whole Dharma talk. Maybe I'll do that as the next one, but I'll say them again and see if you can get the point of each one. Prevent the arising of unarisen, unwholesome states. So crappy things that you don't want to ever come up. Abandon unwholesome states that have already arisen. Okay, this thing came up. It's no good. So I want to abandon it. Arouse wholesome states that have not yet arisen. So this is like metta, right? Maybe I haven't had that feeling of ease, peace. I need to bring it up. Bring it some energy. And then to maintain and perfect wholesome states that have already arisen. Oh, I feel this goodness, this metta, whatever. Let me see if I can sustain it. Right, mindfulness. So mindfulness can have two meanings. In one sense, it's the quality of being aware of what's happening in the present. The paying attention. And the second is remembering. Remembering where we are in the here and now. It isn't enough, however, to merely see what is happening. Clear comprehension is the quality of discernment, the ability to understand fully what is happening in the light of wisdom. On the deepest level, what is happening is the rising and passing away of phenomena. With mindfulness, we remember the instructions to focus on what is happening without interpretations, so without stories, right? Without delusion. The four foundations of mindfulness are mindfulness of body, feeling, tones, the mind, and of mental objects. And then the last one is contemplation or concentration. Samadhi is a one-pointedness of mind. In meditation, we bring our attention to a single object, usually breath. The mind remains focused there, serving as a benchmark for mental phenomena to come and go. There are two components of mental development, tranquility, samatha, and insight, vipassana. Both are necessary and not different paths or practices. With tranquility, one forms conditions for insight. Right concentration offers us peace, clarity, and contentment. So, last night, in closing, last night I was dead asleep and I heard presumably a couple or maybe just two people outside yelling at each other. And I mean yelling. And this was like early in the morning, maybe 3 something in the morning. And one of them was just cursing, like, give me my phone back, give me my phone back. And at first I was really I was like annoyed, of course, right? Like, well, I told you I hadn't been able to get sleep for the past over a week. And I finally was getting good sleep. And then I heard it. I know Daisy is like, yes. And I was so annoyed. And then I thought, that has so been me. Even if it's not with another person, like the ways that I talk to myself, like, damn it, that's me. You know, and then I felt really like I just started sending both of them metta. I was like, God, peace, ease, geez, I know what that feels like. And then I remembered listening to this Dharma talk, preparing for tonight, and she said, stop feeding the fire and it will cease. And I thought about the translation of Nibbana, which is really just cooling off. That's all this practice is. It's not feeding anything that's going to bring more suffering. And I just thought, gosh, maybe I should like throw a meditation flyer out. You know? You deserve better than this. There's sukha in the world. Go find it. You know. So yeah, I'll end with a poem. It's not really a poem, but everything Thich Nhat Hanh says sounds like a poem. When your favorite cloud is no longer in the sky, you are sad. When a cloud is no longer seen in the sky, you think that the cloud is not there. And you think that the cloud now belongs to the realm of non-being. That is a wrong perception. You think your cloud has died. But it is impossible for a cloud to die, because to die means that from something, you become absolutely nothing. If you are caught by the appearance of the cloud, you will not be able to see your cloud in its continuation. You have to see your cloud in the rain, in your tea. Hello, my cloud. I see that you are in a new form, the rain, my tea.